Welcome to episode 86 of this Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and having compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Nandita Bajaj. Nandita is the Executive Director of Population Balance, a non-profit organization which works to address the impacts of human overpopulation and overconsumption on the planet, people, and non-human animals. She's also the co-director of the Fair Start Movement, which works on legal and educational reform towards a sustainable and just family planning model. She's also faculty within the Institute for Humane Education, where she teaches a course called Pronatalism and Overpopulation, about the pervasive pressure on women to have children and the impact on them, families, non-human animals, and the earth. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 85 others. Don't forget to work through our back catalogue if you've just found us. Every person who reviews and rates or shares our podcast with a friend or 10 helps us nudge more people towards more compassionate, rational thinking. Our latest 5-star review is from Just Looking for a Good Pod on Apple, who says, a podcast about what really matters, super engaging discussions about what drives the moral and epistemological approaches of super interesting and impressive people. Thank you very much. That's kind. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates or search for Sentientism on your favorite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Nandita. How are you?
I'm great, Jamie. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure to have you join this series of sentientist conversations. Thanks for making the time. And as we've spoken briefly about, these conversations really focus on what I think of as the two deepest questions, what's real and what matters. And I have an obvious bias because I'm trying to popularize and develop this very simple worldview called sentientism, which I summarize as evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. When it comes to what's real, I suggest we should take a naturalistic approach using evidence and reason. And when it comes to what matters, the clue is in the name, that we should think about sentience, the capacity to experience, particularly suffering and flourishing, as you know, the most important thing in our ethical system. But I'm talking to people in these conversations who agree and disagree with that, different aspects of that philosophy. So it would be fascinating to understand your own personal journey and where you've got to now. But before we get to those crazily broad and deep questions, how would you best introduce yourself and your work?
I've had a bit of an evolutionary journey into my career.
Yeah, you have quite a CV. It's amazing.
Yes. I don't know if what that says, if it's I'm fickle-minded or I'm evolving.
You're a polymath.
Yes. I started out as an engineer. I worked in the field of engineering for a few years, and then I shifted into education to find something more meaningful. And I worked in a high school teaching math and physics and working in administration for about 10 years. Then I went back to school again more recently to do my grad degree in humane education. And for those of us who are those of you who are new to humane education, it's a framework that looks at global issues from a perspective of human rights, animal protection, and environmental restoration. And through my degree, I took a focus on pronatalism, which is the simply put social pressures put on people, especially women, to have children, their connection to overpopulation, and then also anthropocentrism, which is something you're very familiar with, a human supremacist worldview. And then looking at the intimate links between those and the impacts that has on people, on animals, on the planet as a whole. And as a result of my focus, I then shifted careers one more time to work more directly in the field of population stabilization and challenging pronatalism. So I now work as the ED of a small nonprofit called Population Balance, which looks at the impacts of overconsumption, overpopulation, et cetera, on the planet.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And we'll come to some of those issues when we talk about you know, how to make the world a better place at the end of this conversation. And we were put in touch by one of the leading lights in humane education, Zoe Weil, who I had the pleasure of interviewing a few episodes back, so quite a few episodes back. So
she is incredible. Yeah, that program, which she started 25 years ago, has completely broadened my worldview. Yeah. And I can never go back to not seeing things in such a interconnected way.
It's an amazing perspective. And do you still work as faculty with Humane Education now as well, or is that something else you've...
Yes. So but I also, thank you for reminding me, joined Institute for Humane Education, where I just graduated, to teach a few courses on human rights, environmental ethics. And then there's a course that I designed as part of my capstone called Pronatalism and Overpopulation.
Thank you. Well, let's move on now to those two deep questions. And the first one, what's real? For many of my guests, that's a story about whether they grew up originally in society and a family that was more focused on a supernatural or a spiritual or a religious worldview of some sort, or one that was more naturalistic or agnostic or atheist, and how their philosophy on that side of, you know, the big questions has shifted over time, if it has. So you can wind the clock back as far as you like, but it'd be fascinating to know your journey on, you know, what should we believe about reality and how should we believe?
Yeah. I think at a personal level, I grew up in India until I was 17.
Yeah.
And it's a very conservative culture. And even though I grew up in a fairly like semi-liberal household, there were strong undertones of spirituality and religiosity in India.
And which part of India were you in?
I actually moved around quite a bit, but mostly in the north, northwest.
Yeah.
I think that has some linkage to my proclivities to change, is we moved every 3 years and I had to redefine myself and figure out my, you know, surroundings and my friends and et cetera. So I think that I've kind of become wired to desire change and look for new things. But religion-wise, my parents weren't staunchly religious. We followed all of the holidays and traditions. And even the little bit of adherence that they had to religion, it felt fairly transactional. In that, you know, it was fear-based. You do certain things so that you can be rewarded, and you avoid certain things so you're not punished. So it felt quite conditional, where it wasn't motivated, at least in my kind of larger family, didn't feel like it was motivated by some deeper sense of purpose, but rather there's a God, or thousands rather. I don't think I was as influenced by religion as a result, or influenced is maybe not the right word, but I wasn't motivated or interested in it as a result of what I saw around me, because there was so much juxtaposition in the kinds of things I would see, people treating certain other people or beings differently.
Yeah.
But then when it came to their own family or their own inner circle, you know, suddenly there was a God that would protect them and, you know, their little circle, and they'd do anything to get there. So it seemed self-serving in some ways. And maybe just the experience that I had, I'm not really speaking to the culture as a whole.
Yeah, but it didn't sort of emotionally engage you. It was, as you said, felt a bit more transactional, a bit more conditional, and maybe a little bit tribal, right? We're, you know, is the right God on our side versus those other people and or those other beings?
So true. Yeah. And in the tribal sense, like so many superstitions, it was like, if you do this, this would happen. And if you don't do this, this would happen.
Yeah.
And it just didn't make a lot of sense to me. So I departed from it quite early on. And it wasn't until I moved to Canada when I was 17, I immigrated here with my family. a few years after I went to university, and that's really where I started dabbling into self-discovery processes.
Yeah.
I was studying engineering, but I could take any number of electives, and I chose to take psychology. So not quite into the philosophical yet, but I became so fascinated by all of these psychology courses, because suddenly I started to realize that all of who I thought I was, all of these pieces of my identity, were for the most part socially constructed.
Yeah. You can sort of see how the different bits fitted together and examine yourself in a different way. Kind of, yeah.
Yeah. So I started to realize, you know, all of who I thought that I was, and all of these parts of me, my body and my mind, and these attitudes and behaviors and emotions that I thought that were mine and belonged to me, were so mediated and deeply socialized. And that became a really interesting journey for me, is to start deconstructing a lot of those pieces.
Yeah. And before we talk about that process, because that's fascinating in its own right, you talked about, leaving the religious worldview behind. Was that something you just did sort of quietly without telling anyone, or did you make a big production of it? Was it a difficult process for you emotionally, intellectually, socially, or one that was quite simple and just sort of sat in the background? How did the process of moving away work?
I think it was fairly straightforward.
Yeah.
Because my family, my parents were not deeply religious, I didn't have to make a big deal that I was departing from my religious beliefs. I don't think I even told them that I was. I still continued to participate in a lot of the traditions with them out of respect for, you know, for their tradition. But I was, you know, quite half-hearted inside. I wasn't motivated by those things. So it didn't seem like a big production. There were a lot of other productions that happened in my life, departing from other beliefs and ideas, but religion wasn't one of them.
Yeah. Thank you. That makes sense. Because that's one of the fascinating things about my guests, is that for you and for me, you know, that switch was reasonably easy because we both came from quite liberal backgrounds where religion wasn't absolutely central to the definition and the identity of, you know, the society and the family we're part of. And others of my guests have had, you know, some of them extremely traumatic, you know, journeys away from that worldview. So that's interesting to know. So yeah, to jump forward again to this deconstruction you were going through, that's interesting, because it's almost like a not necessarily a rebuilding, but a sort of recognition of, you know, maybe where your beliefs and values had came from, examining them, and then, you know, maybe a process of rebuilding something different. But
yeah. And I started to realize in this deconstruction process was that who I was made to believe I was actually very limited and finite, and in a lot of ways, self-serving. You know, I do things so that I can succeed in life, so I can do, you know, get a good job, so I can be wealthy and I can have a good reputation, all of those things. Mm. Even though I was studying engineering at the time, I started becoming so much more interested in this process of identity formation and figuring out, well, if I'm not that and or that, well, then who am I really? And what motivates me deeply that's not coming from a place of pleasing my parents or, you know, being a good person, being a good citizen on a conditional basis of what people are expecting from me, but rather, what am I driven by from the deepest part of me, and who is that?
Yeah, as opposed to compliance with some norms or some rules or a deity or something else. That would be fascinating to get to on the second question, because I guess that's part of this process of working out, you know, what matters and why. But to stick on the first question about what's real and the sort of epistemological side, some of my guests have moved away from a religious worldview and, like me, gone down a sort of fairly classically naturalistic path. So, you know, I became, you know, you might call it an extreme agnostic or an atheist when it comes to thinking about deities. I think naturalistically about basically everything. You know, I won't believe things. I'll hold credence back until I see evidence for them of different types. And I'll try and set my sort of credence in any belief about the world based on how strong that evidence seems to be. And that's an imperfect process, of course, but, you know, I don't see a better alternative than evidence and reason. So I've followed a fairly classic path from, you know, a soft religious worldview, supernatural worldview, if you like, to one that's, you know, quite hard-edged and clear and naturalistic, albeit hopefully with some humility in it. Others have followed that path, but then gone on to something else. And others have moved away from a religious worldview, but retained some aspect of the supernatural. So for some, it's, you know, spiritual, but not religious. For some people, it's there might be other aspects of, you know, the magical or the spiritual or something beyond things we can naturalistically understand. Are there any elements of those things in your worldview, or are you more, you know, classically naturalistic like me, if you like?
Yeah, I think through the process of departing from one, starting to become interested in identity, I did end up kind of in the process of reconstruction, trying to figure out what motivates me and what are ethics, what's philosophy. I started to delve into philosophy and both Eastern and Western philosophy, but from this newfound place of interest rather than, like you said, compliance. And I've read a lot. I attended workshops and retreats. And along the path, I started to discover for myself that there is this deep reverence that I hold, not for a god, not for a being, but for the process of the, you know, the evolution of our, the entire evolutionary process. And there is a certain unknowing, as you said, coming from a place of humility, leaning into this sense of unknowing, of non-certainty, that all of what we don't yet know or will never know, but there seems to be some kind of miraculousness to it, to the process. Again, not coming from this religious miracle, but the millions and millions of years it's taken for this entire process to unfold. The interconnectedness between the smallest of microbes to, you know, these nitrogen-fixing bacteria or the dead leaves, you know, that serve a purpose for their tiny little ecosystem, and starting to realize we are such a small part of this really big kind of supposedly infinite process.
Somewhat mind-blowing, isn't it?
And it's, I think it's coming from that deep time perspective that really started to land for me, that there is something much bigger going on around us that is bigger than my thoughts and feelings and my body and my mind, that I don't yet understand, but I have had experiences that tell me that it this can't just be it.
You know? Yeah, that's fascinating.
So I'd say I do believe in some kind of mystery to the universe, but in the greatest possible sense, that is that is still driven by science, that is still driven by evidence, but also that can't be limited just to evidence, because so much of what we don't know is yet to be discovered, and we may never have evidence to prove kind of this deep sense that we experience.
And I think I'd share almost everything you said there, because there's just the complexity and richness and awesomeness of the universe is totally mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing just to think at quite a local scale, but then when you think about the planet, and then when you think about the solar system, and then the galaxy, and then the universe, and it's just, you know, in a way, it is just a genuine awe, because I guess our role as sort of particular branch of evolved apes that, you know, not that long ago wandering around the savannah, in a blink of an eye, have now got to this stage where we can have our minds blown by our already limited understanding of everything that's around us. And I think I'd absolutely share that sort of sense of awe and wonder and mystery. And for me, the distinction is, the overlap, the commonality is believing based on evidence, but recognizing the limits of that evidence. And to my mind, that is the essence of a scientific or a naturalistic worldview, is never taking your own evidence too seriously, because it's always incomplete, it's always partial. You may always find something new out tomorrow. So that's why that humility is important. To my mind, it doesn't make sense to draw artificial boundaries and say, you know, we should give up working on the evidence because there are some things it's impossible to know. We should always keep trying to find out more. And I think it's also important not to say, you know, evidence is limited, so let's make some stuff up because yes, it feels good, right? So I think that those are probably things we'd share as well. But whether we talk about it being in terms of mystery or reverence, or whether we talk about it as, you know, just this sense of even a naturalistic awe and wonder about the interconnectedness of all things just through an understanding of physics and biology and systems. And, you know, I think there's a strong overlap there. That's fascinating.
Yeah, I agree.
And the other thing I've found is that one of the reasons I like to talk about this, you know, what's real question and then the what matters question, is because there is often a strong link. And one of the themes that seems to come through these conversations, and you've hinted at some of the problems already, is that under a sort of classically religious version of supernaturalism, and there's loads of other types of supernaturalism as well, there can be problems that warp compassionate ethics. So most religious systems have compassion at their heart, you know, the golden rule and caring about others and ahimsa and so on, that, you know, compassion is always a strong element. But as you've said, sometimes it can be constrained or conditional, or, you know, something else can be put as more important than the lowly humans and other sentient beings that can excuse problems. But often what I find with my guests who've moved away from a religious worldview but still aren't strictly naturalistic, right, they leave some space to say, you know, maybe there is something bigger or broader or magical or mystical. That more generic sense of a possibility about the supernatural seems to be much less likely to warp ethics. Whereas when it's more of a classical religious worldview, they seem to come with bundles of ethics that often don't really line up with what I think ethics should be if they're compassionate. So it's an interesting balance. But
yeah, it's so true what you're saying, because there's with a lot of the religious texts or belief systems, there is a sense of finiteness, right? There's just like you do these things because that's what the scriptures say. Anything beyond that that is unknowable is not we don't really delve into that. There's a fear of the unknown, of going too far from what our texts say. So
and in
that
some
sense,
systems, you're also not supposed to be questioning either, which I find difficult. But
and that with that worldview also comes this sense of unwholesome certainty.
Yeah,
you know everything you need to know, and you cannot depart from those structures or worldviews.
Yeah.
But when you just really take a humble position and say, out of the entire universe, we know, you know, 0.0001% or even less. And how can certainty even enter the conversation when so much of what we're surrounded by is not known to us, unknowable? Yeah.
It's an amazing level of arrogance to be that confident about something, you know, this mind-blowingly complex and awesome. So, yeah, it's interesting. And so maybe we should move on to this second question, because it's quite hard to disconnect the two, and I think that's a healthy thing. But when we talk about what matters morally, there's two parts to this question often. One, which is, you know, what's the grounding of our ethics and morality? What really matters? And the other one is one of moral scope, and ultimately who matters and what matters, and how that changes other people's lives. And it sounds like you were, you know, this is what you were working through in this process of deconstruction, because maybe people who walk away from a religious worldview do sometimes feel like there's a gap that's opened up, because the religious worldview came with a list of rules or a deity or, you know, an ethics that I would argue is probably warped unhealthily, but it's a system, right? And then if you say, well, I don't have that system anymore, you know, where do you go next? And some people will go down a sort of nihilist path. Well, if there isn't a deity to look over my shoulder, then nothing matters. Others will follow a sort of relativist approach, which say, well, there's no real basis for morality, it's just what we negotiate. Others will find some other way forward. So yeah, it'd be great to pick up the story of your sort of deconstruction and reconstruction and think about where you got to on this ethical question of what matters and who matters.
Yeah. To start with the question about were there any gaps after I left the religious worldview, I felt it was the opposite.
Yeah.
I found so many loopholes in the religious worldview, even though I, you know, adhering to it too seriously, it wasn't able to answer so many questions for me. And to then just like open myself up to this gigantic world of mystery, of things that I don't yet know or will never know, there was this sense of fullness rather than emptiness or gaps.
Interesting. Yeah.
I don't think I can say that now I have a complete picture of the world and I feel confident that this is more real than that, but it's just a sense of wonder and being okay with not knowing and being comfortable with realizing that all of who I thought I was is not all. Maybe, you know, obviously the fact that we're having this conversation means there is some part of us that is motivated by something different than what's socially constructed. But so much of who we are is socialized, mediated. And so when we start parting ways from those blocks of identity, then I do, the sense that I've started feeling is just questioning more things. It's like, who created the boundaries between species? Who decided at some point that we humans were superior to every other being on Earth?
Yeah.
And that we can dominate and humanize the entire world? And then you start going further, and who decided that certain species are worth more, worthy of, you know, more love and care or morality than other species, just by virtue of the way they look or, you know, the way they behave or how similar they are to us. And it was just this arbitrary measure of, you know, this hierarchical attributions of assigning value to beings based on our really limited worldview.
You're recognizing that, I guess, a lot of our moral thinking, as well as our epistemological thinking, is sort of laid down by social norms, and you're questioning those and challenging them and breaking them down. And I guess, you know, questioning the, whether they're really well-grounded and what their validity actually is, or whether they are to some degree arbitrary, you know, and you used the term before, self-serving. You know, us humans are very good at categorizing things and others. And that's a useful thing to do just to understand the world, but we're very good at categorizing in ways that serve our own ends, even if they're not well-founded. One of the difficulties, obviously, with that, because I think that questioning approach is deeply important, because that process should never end, right? If we're going to be humble about our morals and humble about our beliefs, you know, questioning is perpetual, right? We should never stop, because stopping questioning is dogma in a way. But at the same time, we've got to find some sort of landing places on the way. We can't just question forever. So as you went through that process of deconstruction and questioning, where would you say you've landed in terms of thinking about, you know, what ethics and morality are, and this question about moral scope and how far should we extend it, and what and who matters?
Yeah, you're right. There has to be some level of confidence and certainty. You can't
We need like a working hypothesis that we can decide how to act in the meantime, right? We might find out later we were wrong, but
yeah. So I think where I've landed is that I feel I'm deeply motivated by this place of respect and awe and reverence for the process, but for the planet itself and all the beings on the planet, and recognizing that every single aspect of what exists plays some role in this interconnected world.
Yeah.
And so that's where the awe comes from, is there's just this deep respect for all of the interconnectedness. And then the motivation is to protect that, which is so beautiful and feels true and feels real to whatever degree we can define it as real. And so I come from this place of care, which is a really recent phenomenon for me.
Yeah.
On this kind of evolutionary path of figuring out who I am, and I'm, you know, still figuring that out. But I feel quite comfortable in the position that at least my purpose, as far as I know right now, is to protect this miraculous process, the planet that we're on, and do whatever I can to uphold this process, this miraculousness of interconnectivity between the different, you know, beings.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating, because we've used a couple of the terms already. In one of the choices, if you like, as you think about moral scope, is along this spectrum from, you know, anthropocentrism, where you focus on humans, to where I guess I am, sentiocentrism and sentientism, which focus on sentient beings. But it feels like your worldview goes beyond that. So there's biocentrism, which is caring about all living things and, again, how they're connected together. But then there's even ecocentrism or holism, which is, again, as you're explaining, you know, having a sense of reverence and caring morally about the entire ecosystem and how that connects together, even to the extent that, you know, non-sentient stuff is part of those systems as well, rocks and rivers and trees and mountains and habitats and species and so on. So it seems like your moral scope, if you like, has gone to that full broad extent, and that your sense of care is not just care for the individual beings within those systems, it is a care for the system as a whole. Is that fair to characterize?
I think it is. Yeah. You've clarified that for me, actually.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah. And so,
yeah.
And in a way, again, I'm probably guilty in these conversations, because I'm always really keen to find common ground. So sometimes there's a risk I'm papering over disagreements just because I like to be nice. But I do think there's genuine common ground here, because I tend to take quite a strict sentiocentric view, which means that in intrinsic terms, all moral value is about the experiences of sentient beings, which in simple terms is, you know, human and non-human animals, right? But I would argue that on the current scientific understanding, plants aren't sentient, rocks aren't sentient, rivers aren't sentient. So in a sense, I don't think you can harm a rock or a river or a plant. You can't cause them to experience suffering in the same way as a pig or a rabbit or a chicken or a dog or a human can experience suffering. So I do draw that line. But at the same time, I have a rich concern for ecosystems and living things and all of the things we're talking about, because they're so critical to the sentient beings. But I care about those things, if you like, in an instrumental way, not in their own right. So I see an absolutely deeply radical moral difference between, you know, cutting a carrot and cutting a pig, right? Because one is sentient and one is not. So even with a quite strict sentiocentric view, there's still a lot of overlap, because I will still care about the environment and the ecosystem and the planet as a whole,
yes,
too. But it's just for a slightly different reason. And I guess one of the reasons why I focus on that view is because I think I'm quite open to people having a broader view that goes beyond where I am and says, that's great, Jamie, we care about all the sentient beings, but I also care directly about this other stuff as well. I'm quite open to that, as long as the sentient beings don't get ignored in that process. And that's one challenge I do have with some people who have a holistic, really broad ecocentric view. And I'd argue this is where the modern environmental movement generally is today, which is they've gone from an anthropocentric concern about humans, and then they've gone, right, climate change, environmental destruction, you know, we need to really care about the entire ecosystem and the planet as Gaia. But in doing so, they are still excluding most sentient beings, wild and farm, from their moral consideration, which implies to me that it's not really a generous ecocentric concern. It's just another version of anthropocentrism. The reason they care about the environment is because of what it might do to humans, but they're not concerned with the farm sentient beings or the wild sentient beings at all, really. So it's just, you know, anthropocentrism in a disguise once again, right? And us humans are good at that. So, but some people have explained that to me by saying, look, I care about this entire system, you know, Earth as Gaia, the entire ecosystem, the process works.
humans are just a tiny insignificant part of that cycle. Like, we shouldn't be arrogant. We are just part of that process, that incredible, almost infinite process. And as part of that process, you know, life emerges, life suffers, life dies. There are cycles. You know, I could start singing the circle of life now, although my voice is terrible, so I won't do that. But, you know, and as part of those cycles, life consumes life, light eats life. And as part of that, us humans must play our part. So, you know, I'll have a bacon sandwich and milkshake, please. And I don't want to paint too skeptical a picture, but that's quite a common view. You know, there's a reverence for the system, but they've forgotten to have to show care for the beings that can actually suffer within that system.
Yes.
So how would you respond to someone who challenged you and said, Nandita, I share your view. We have a reverence for the entire system. Us humans just need to play our part. And as long as we do so with reverence, animal farming is fine.
Yes. I would ask them to define what reverence means to them.
Yeah.
You know, because it's, this is, so many of our conversations revolve around this cognitive dissonance of caring for, like you're saying, sometimes it can just seem to be a morally superior worldview, but it's not really a worldview because you haven't dug deeply enough into your own psychology for, you know, why you're having such a difficult time deciding what deserves our moral consideration. And I think that's really where the psychology piece keeps coming back to me is I wish we were all forced to take psychology in high school to realize how much of who we are is constructed. It's a lot of it is just a lie. You know, it's not, we become so deeply identified with those pieces of ourselves, and then we become so arrogant and certain about protecting those parts of ourselves that this is where the cognitive dissonance really has a field day.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you've got all of this identity to protect instead of just saying it's true, it's not, you know, it's a lie, this is not really right when you start looking at what reverence truly means. You know, there's death and life involved, but to take 80 billion animals and to put them from birth to their death into a scenario that is abysmal and truly violent and one of the most, you know, violent processes that we engage in. Somebody comes back to tell me they have an ecocentric worldview. There's a lot to challenge there. How they define reverence.
And we're good at redefining what these terms mean to us, right? We redefine what reverence means. We redefine what caring means. We redefine what humane means in, you know, crazily warped ways to justify the things we want to keep doing. But I agree with you. I think if someone is technically a biocentrist or an ecocentrist, they have to care about the sentient beings too, because those sentient beings are part of the biosphere and they are part of the ecosphere. And I would argue that if someone does grant direct moral consideration to plants and rocks and rivers and trees, they at least have to grant moral consideration to the sentient beings too. And I would also ask those people, say, that's fine, you care about these things and you care about all of them, but surely this capacity to experience suffering still means something extra on top of that consideration. And I think you're right that when you scratch away at that, you know, you can discover some underlying motivations that sadly are very different. And I'd agree with your fascination with psychology, because with so many, you know, as we move to this final question of thinking about the future, it strikes me through these conversations that many of the problems we're talking about, whether they're in the human sphere or the non-human sphere, really aren't that technically difficult to solve, right? We don't need a technical solution. Quite often it is a problem of human psychology and how that translates through to political will.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think that's probably the, you know, a great place to focus is actually on the weirdness of human psychology is probably one of the deepest, biggest problems that then feeds all of the other problems we see. But before we move on to that final question, how did that process of reconstructing and particularly expanding that moral scope play through in your life? Because I'm assuming that when you grew up originally, you know, you weren't thinking in that way about non-humans and ecosystems. And as you went through this process of deconstructing and then reconstructing and then feeling this broader reverence. How hard was that for you to work through practically in your life? Because one of the other things that's fascinating in these conversations is quite often people will come to an intellectual realization or a philosophical realization or a psychological realization, but then it's still quite a long journey before we're able to break out of the social norms and make practical changes. When we come to topics like animal farming, it took me embarrassingly long really to make the changes, some of the obvious changes I wish I'd done earlier. What was that process like for you?
Yeah, I remember you had asked me if there was kind of any big production or backlash in departing from religion. So there wasn't any there. But as I started discovering all of these social norms that were guiding my path and how compliant I was trying to be in being that good person in a very limited sense, I started realizing it wasn't what made me happy or what brought me fulfillment. And so I started parting ways from all of the things that my parents had taught me were the right path for me. I had expected, I would become a successful person, get married, do all of the conveyor belt stuff, have two kids. That's what I was raised to see all around me, was everyone was having two or three kids. And I thought, well, that's just what I will do, even though I had never deeply considered if that was the right path for me. And be successful, be, wealthy and all of the benchmarks that are set out. And it started for me in my mid-20s when, after university, I decided I was going to leave home. I don't know to do what, but just to be on my own, to individuate. In Indian culture, you don't really leave home until you get married. So I was 25 when I left home, which to a lot of my friends was kind of late in the game. But for my parents, it was World War III because, I was breaking tradition in a big way. And then I was going to be on my own and really going into the unknown. And there's such a fear of the unknown in most cultures, but, in traditional conservative cultures, especially when you're living in a country that is not as familiar to you or the values of which you don't totally align with, because, they can seem too liberal to a conservative family. That seemed like a really big deal. I mean, my dad and I didn't speak for a year because he was so upset. But again, I don't know what was motivating me, but I just knew that I needed to move away from this kind of finite construct that I was living within so that I could figure more out for myself and keep, scratching the surface of who I am and what I want to be and where do I want to put my efforts and my mind and body to. And that to me was the beginning of this journey of recognition of, well, I'm not that or that. And therefore I'm going to start, delving into philosophy more. I'm going to switch careers to find something more meaningful. And all of those things that I was doing, switching careers, going back to school, to my parents or even, within my culture, it could seem like it's fickle-minded or you just can't find your path. Why can't you just settle down? And to me, it was this idea that we have a limited time on the planet. There's a sense of urgency to figure out what am I supposed to be doing here? With what am I to do with all of this awe and reverence that I have for the process and all of the serendipitous experiences I'm having with, feeling like the universe is trying to conspire to align me with something bigger. How do I respond to that without making someone else uncomfortable or angry? Because I'm not complying, and supposedly not seeming like knowing myself, because there's such a limited definition of knowing yourself is you appear confident and you are certain and you know what you're doing and you tell everybody that look at what I've
whether it's a facade or not.
Yes. And I was none of that because I was not settling into anything that was defined or known. Well, not completely anything. I live in a certain place. I am married and I do conform to certain social norms, but in a way that makes sense to me because not all social norms are ridiculous and bad.
Yeah.
It's just when we follow them blindly without realizing what is the definition of success and happiness and fulfillment for me, rather than what's been told is going to bring me those things.
Yeah.
And so from that place, I really started to get more involved in the more earthly, things of what are causes that I really care deeply about. That kind of brought me back to the psychology and the conditioning and how conditioning impacts so much of what we do and how we define our lives.
Yeah.
And then we expect results to line up with how everyone else is experiencing it. As in, this is supposed to make me happy, so I'm just going to do this. But not questioning for ourselves if that truly does make us happy. And so,
And that brings us on to this final question about, how can we make the world a better place and what can we do to influence the future? And it feels like that's one of the strong themes in your work is trying to address that psychology and challenge social norms and help other people, find a way forward, which I guess is part of your work with humane education as well. But that's what I'm interested to get on to next is in the context of your thinking about what's real and what matters, the different themes of your thought about how can we make things better? Yeah, this psychology and social norms seems like a big theme.
Yeah, and it's a big theme because I think they really get in the way of us figuring out for ourselves who we are and figuring out like the bigger definition of I that's not defined by these tiny blocks of identity that's constructed socially. And so the work that I became deeply interested in through my graduate work in humane education was this concept of pronatalism, which is the societal pressure that is placed on people to have children and the promise of perfection that is sold as, the most fulfilling path for everyone, and that that having children is the most natural and normal thing to do.
Yeah.
And for a lot of people, like I said, not all social norms are untrue or unwholesome. For a lot of people, it is true. It is the right path and it is a fulfilling path. But it's when an idea is sold, kind of like success or happiness, is sold as a, be-all solution to emptiness within yourself. And in this case, it's having kids that will bring you that sense of purpose or fulfillment before you've even had a chance to figure out for yourself who you are. And are you coming from a place of fullness or emptiness in going after something? And
can it even sometimes create the emptiness? Because I think there's a lot to be said for, the enrichment that you can have in your own life through having children. But sometimes if the message is so strong, it can almost imply that your only purpose as an individual sentient being is to bring more sentient beings into the world, right? So there's almost an implication there that you yourself have no real value, right? Your only purpose is to have the children and that's it. So in that sense, it almost is emptying out the individual and saying, you're basically just a machine, produce the children, that's it. And then you think, well, if the point is to have children and the point of those children is just to have more children, where is the actual value? Isn't there value in a life, in an experience? So it feels like it can almost empty out. It's often framed as a way of saying, here's how you can have some value. And then it almost feels like for some people, and I would argue, you know, often it's women, it's almost emptying it out, saying, look, that's your only role really on this planet.
So, so true. Yeah, well put. And it is, it's this, when we're sold a certain belief, I think if you hear it enough times, you start to believe it,
yeah,
that you are truly empty unless you do so-and-so, you know, thing, whether it is finding a partner, whether it is having kids, you're made to believe that you're not complete and full until you derive it from someone else.
Yeah.
And the problem with doing that through having children without figuring out for yourself whether it is truly an autonomous, liberated, responsible choice you're making is you're giving birth to another human being. You know, it's not just an activity that you're engaging in. Yeah. You are bringing in another being onto the planet that is going to have their own impacts on the planet, will have to figure out their own relationship to the world, what worldview they're going to inherit. And if they're going to inherit a worldview of emptiness from you, that's concerning. And, you know, there are other aspects of your identity that really get diminished when you are made to believe that that is the only purpose that you have, or you're somehow lacking if you don't follow that life path. And along with that set of beliefs, people who are ambivalent or certain that they don't want kids or they can't have kids are left to feel a certain sense of lack in society. That they've failed somehow in the one thing that the world has told them there is their purpose. And it can cause so much suffering, so much confusion, but also for people who go into the decision without giving it a lot of thought, following the path because that's what's been told they should do, and then experiencing suffering as a result because they realize that that was not the path that they should have taken. It doesn't bring them the happiness or fulfillment, or it impacts their relationship, you know, with their partner or with their work or with their life purpose, or, you know, with their whatever, you know, mystery or worldview that they have. So that became my interest because initially I came to it from a place of really being concerned about overpopulation and what that was doing to our planet, what that was doing to more marginalized human communities, ecological communities, sentient beings. You know, there's such a direct correlation between our numbers going up and the extinction of animals and plants. Being directly correlated to that.
Yeah. And one of the things I found interesting, because again, I'm an amateur in this space, but I've seen some of the presentations you've done, and often people will go, well, here's the human population graph. And they will say, look, here's the extinction, here's the climate change challenges, here's the emissions. And interestingly, there's often an intermediate factor that people miss out, because, you know, of course there are challenges with having 7.9 billion humans on the planet and we have a direct impact on the planet, but when you look at land use and water use and emissions and so on, it's often not from the 8 billion humans, it's from another population you mentioned before, the, you know, 80 90 billion land animals that we farm for agriculture. So in a way, there's a, you know, there's an amplifier effect on the human population through what we're doing with farmed animals, and also the arable agriculture we need to feed them all, that is actually a more direct impact on the ecosystems and the planet than technically the human population it would be itself. But
yeah, and you know, the human population can't be decoupled from the desires for consumption that we have on,
they go together at the moment,
the planet.
Anyway.
Yes, I mean, the more of us, you know, there are, and our, you know, our interest and proclivity toward wealth and acquisition, and, you know, meat is considered a delicacy in so many cultures, and as they're becoming wealthier, the meat consumption is going up, and it will only go that way. So, I mean, you know, in my work, I say veganism is not really about not consuming animal products. It is an existential position you have to know the impact you're having on the animals, not just through not eating them, through not consuming, you know, products in the form of, you know, clothing and articles, but just by your very existence, our very existence, we are having an impact.
Yeah.
The roads and highways and the infrastructure that is being built for me, my, you know, transportation is being built on someone else's home and they're being pushed out. And you put 7.9 billion of us and you can see and tie that in with the anthropocentric worldview and you can see the lives, you know, of which individuals become diminished.
Yeah.
Not to say that human communities are not suffering from our own increase in numbers.
Yeah.
Right. It's a social justice issue, but it's also an ecological justice issue. It's a intergenerational justice issue for the beings that are going to exist in the future, who are going to have worse lives than we will.
Yeah. And the numbers on population are amazing. I mean, when you look at the charts of the rate of our human population growth, it's absolutely incredible in terms of the rate and the power, particularly when you look over a few hundred or few thousand years. It basically goes like this and then goes bang.
Yes.
But at the same time, the projections at the moment are already population growth is slowing. And as I understand it, that's partly an implication of improved development, reduced poverty and availability of reproductive rights and, you know, all of those, I guess, generically progress type things that are going on. And you'll know this better than I can, but the projections seem to be that the population growth is slowing now and might continue to slow such that when we get to the end of this century, we might sort of stop. I mean, who knows, right? We might stop at about 11 billion, but even 11 billion is still, you know, 3 billion more than we are now. And we're already, through, as you say, our consumption and our footprint causing plenty of problems. So, you know, even if this growth is slowing, you can still argue there's a problem there. So that's why it's a fascinating right. space. And population is a really touchy topic because I think most of your discussion there has been about thinking about the individuals taking choices and being subject to this pronatalist culture and those individuals thinking instead what really is best for them and potentially for their children. So it's focused on, you know, the individuals, their rights, their capacity, their power, their influence, and their choices, which I would wholeheartedly support in every respect. But it's also a very sensitive topic because some of the people who came from where you started, which is a concern about human population on the ecosystem as a whole, can end up in some pretty unpleasant places in their worldview. So why do you think population is such a contentious and difficult topic? And how do you think we can navigate these challenges so we don't end up in an ethically bad place, but we also don't get so scared of those challenges, we just fail to engage with the topic?
Yeah. And that's the space that you're creating in your work, right? Is the conversations for the gray zones, not being too certain about this or that or binary in our thinking. And this is where we think, this is where I believe we need to be going with complex global issues like human overpopulation.
Yeah.
The reason it is such a sensitive subject is because, you know, there is a history of trying to address overpopulation using some really awful practices, such as forced sterilizations that were foisted upon the most marginalized communities. I mean, just a few years before I was born in India, there was a forced sterilization program where millions of men and women were impacted. They had their reproductive autonomy taken away. And that is still kind of continuing to happen in different places where there's, you know, measures of population control. And that absolutely has to be acknowledged, recognized, and denounced in terms of how we address issues. We don't take away rights from people to afford rights for others. And the other piece that often gets missed out, so this is really what gets brought up a lot of the time, is like, we don't talk about overpopulation because of China's one child policy and look what it did, and because of these programs, and therefore talking about it is inherently racist or, you know, xenophobic. And the conversation stops there.
Yeah.
And that's where, you know, a lot of the environmental organizations will not touch it with a 10-foot pole, because there is such a fear of being seen as being badly motivated.
Yeah.
But the issue
and
that
you can,
we...
And you can understand that fear. I mean, I've had versions of a conversation, you know, on it's Twitter, right? So you'll meet some weird people, right? But I've had some conversation where someone who has said, look, I have this deep worry about the ecosystem and the environment as a whole. I've run some numbers which implies that the Earth's carrying capacity for humans is 3.5 billion humans, not 8 billion. So we need to get down to 3.5 billion humans for the sake of the ecosystem. And I say, well, okay, that's really interesting. How are you going to depopulate the human population from 8 billion to 3.5? And they go very quiet. And the reason they go very quiet is the only way we've ever managed to radically reduce population is famine, war, plague, you know, or deeply unethical, horrific practices like forced sterilization, right? So we should be worried about that dynamic and that line of thinking, but not to the extent which we completely refuse to engage with the topic whatsoever, right? So
exactly.
And because there are so many ethical ways of, with compassion, engaging with this topic in ways that can be win-wins for everybody, I think.
Totally. In fact, there are so many incredible examples in our history that often don't get brought up because, as I said, the conversation just gets, you know, halted before it even begins. But there are countries like Thailand, Costa Rica, Iran, that managed to, within a couple of decades, reduce the fertility rate from over 6 children on average per woman to less than 2, which is the replacement rate. And they were done through empowering, compassionate means, because once you show people, you know, what's good for them, you give access to education to girls and women, you give them opportunities in the workspace, you give them opportunities that take their role beyond just motherhood, you start to see this is what people naturally gravitate towards, is having fewer children that they can care more deeply about. They can invest more time in those kids if they do have them. And for the countries that ended up doing that, it pulled them not just out of poverty, but it also, like you said, uplifted the standards of living and the rights of people, especially women and girls, to a much higher level. And that was truly a win-win situation, because it's all of the things that are needed to address the overpopulation issue are rights-based solutions.
Yeah.
In fact, not addressing overpopulation, because I'm working in that arena, to me, that's a social and ecological justice issue. Because going back to the psychology and going back to social norms, I believe that this, the pressure that's placed on women, especially women, to have children, to have large families, and countries where the fertility rate is the highest are also countries where women have the least degree of reproductive and personal autonomy.
Yeah.
So to say that we shouldn't talk about overpopulation is actually closing the door on uplifting a lot of people from really bad situations that are being foisted upon them, and bringing solutions and, you know, family planning and reproductive technologies to communities that need it the most. And so to me, addressing overpopulation is inherently a wholesome thing to do, because, you know, it relies on lifting people out of pretty unwholesome situations.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. And to bring us back to where we started the conversation, you know, there are clearly, you know, cultural and traditional and naturalistic rationales that lead people to think in a pronatalist way. You know, you can see that theme often coming through even in sort of ethno-nationalist thinking, where it's very much about, you know, the birth rate of the right sort of people compared to the birth rate of the wrong sort of people. And we know where that leads. But there's also a strong religious influence in this space as well. So when you look at reproductive rights, you look at you know, population concerns. You know, just as an example, you look at the influence of the Catholic Church across many less developed nations and what they've told people about contraception. You know, that's absolutely and formulaically and formally, with sanctions, an explicit and very powerful part of this pronatalist way of thinking that explicitly makes it harder for those communities in those countries to develop and for particularly the women in those countries to live the lives they want to live. So, yeah, I agree. I love the way you framed that, because you're recognizing that there are risks in this agenda, but it's really important not to let those scare us away from engaging with it, because there are ways through it that can be driven by empowerment and by compassion and help us, you know, do something that is positive for, you know, the entire system, but also for individual humans too. And how, as you look across that space, how optimistic do you feel about whether we'll make progress on, you know, balancing this pronatalist view? Where do you think the human population might go in the future? What would the implications? So overall, how optimistic or pessimistic do you feel about making traction on that agenda?
Yeah, I think really the reason we find ourselves in this mess is because there have been policies, like you say, driven by religion, driven by cultural traditions, sometimes economy, actually a lot of times economy-driven policies that just keep sounding this baby bust alarmism, saying women aren't having enough babies, so we're not going to have enough laborers to produce more consumers to then keep our GDP growing.
Yeah, people as a resource, as a productive resource, yeah.
Exactly. So this is not just a matter of coincidence that we've ended up here. There has been, you know, a lot of, I would say, manipulation that goes on at the top, you know, whether it's religious leaders, whether it's businesses, whether it's media, governments that are trying to use some really bizarre measure to measure success, that keeps this unsustainable family planning, unjust family planning policy alive. So I really do feel that it's that the shift is going to have to happen both at our own individual psychological levels, where we start to break away from what we think we should be doing. In this case, the work that I'm doing is having children. So that's part of the work, you know, I'm doing is helping people move beyond the shoulds and figuring out for themselves what the right path is. But then I also think policy work is going to be extremely important in order to make big shifts in population stabilization that is done in the most compassionate, humane, and wholesome way, where we actually, number one, we need to do is move away from this baby bust alarmism at a government level. And governments need to actually start pushing for sustainable and just family planning, where people are not seen as numbers. We are not seen as resources. We are seen as individuals with aspirations and desires and deserving of a good life. And this is because it is such a big problem and it is a global issue. It is not going to happen just through individual change. I'm motivated by individual change because I'm interested in personal liberation, but I'm also not naive, you know, that it's going to have to happen at a policy level where the UN needs to step in, the governments need to step in and stop encouraging reproduction. That will be the first step, is just stop encouraging reproduction, but rather start encouraging better investment in families, better investment in children, you know, more respect for individual well-being, rather than just more people.
Yeah.
So really move from this numbers game to an individual, you know, where life is considered precious.
Yeah.
And to really be thoughtful about how we treat it.
And you can tell me I'm pushing this analogy too far, but it feels to me, in a way, there's almost an analogy between thinking about the pronatalist position and how governments and institutions think about human capital and the problem of animal farming. Because in both situations, in this crazy, this is probably pushing it too far, but in both situations, it's about a production, it's about economic output, it's about instrumentalism, and the, yes, the value of each individual sentient life, human or non-human, is somewhat disregarded. It's sort of pushed to the background. And in both instances, I think you're right, when you can recognize that ultimately, and I would say this because I'm pushing sentientism, the root of all value is in the quality of sentient experiences of those individuals, it leads to you to a very different way of thinking about how the world works. And that can't be naive, because, you know, we still need to live and we still need to produce and we still need to exist and so on. But I think if we could recenter that view of value in, I think, what most people intuitively know it really is, because when you dig under, you say, well, why does that matter? Why does that matter? Why does that matter? You will nearly always come back to, because of the way it changes the way a sentient being feels. Well, I think that's, yes, the root of everything.
I agree.
And if we can recenter on that, both for non-human sentience and for human sentience, I think we will find win-wins all over the place, right? And in many cases, maybe the only blocker really is human psychology and political will. And sadly, that's a difficult thing to fix. But yeah, I'm glad people like you are working on it. So I'll probably overstretch that analogy, but
I don't think you have. In fact, this is the space I live in a lot, is there's not a huge difference between how we treat farm animals and how we treat people. And this is why we have such a difficult time in understanding the suffering of others.
Yeah.
Because this is just how we've learned to see people and, you know, human capital, as you said, as resources for a much random goal of economic success, economic wealth. And so you have not stretched it at all. I think it's the same motivation that drives folks to manipulate, exploit people, animals, beings. And, you know, to go a step further, the more of us there are who are being brought up in a way that does not inculcate critical thinking, a way of looking through a lens of empathy and care from, yeah, a place of humane education. Imagine what it's doing to our democracy. How democratic is our process really when this, the same government, the same number of people are now having to look over 10 times more people than there were, you know, 50 years ago, or like twice as many people than there were 50 years ago. The government structure isn't changing. They're just having to care for more people within their own constituencies. How democratic is that process where each person brings in less value, is, you know, has less say in what policy gets passed? So it's all upside down.
Yeah. And that's and the critical thinking you mentioned is really important. And that's one of the reasons I love the humane education philosophy that you and Zoe and others are working on, because some people will say to me, look, why do you need this naturalistic part in sentientism? Why don't you just focus on the sentiocentric compassion? Isn't that enough? And it isn't. It isn't, because I think even someone who is genuinely and richly compassionate, if they don't have the critical thinking abilities and they believe things that just are not true, that can lead even compassionate people to do terrible things. So I do think we need that balance. You need the critical thinking. You need evidence and reason. You need a naturalistic way of understanding the world, because you can't make the world better unless you have a decent understanding of it. And you need, yes, that compassion, that caring, that rich sense of moral consideration for the value of others too. We need both. So.
Absolutely.
Well, it's been absolutely fascinating to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your philosophical journey and, you know, the things you're working on at the moment to try and make the world a better place for human and non-human sentience too. But what's the best way of people following you, learning about your work and supporting what you're doing?
I work at Population Balance, so you could just Google that and populationbalance.org. And then we have our social media by the same names, so easy to find me.
Great. I will include some links in the notes. So.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me and for having this conversation. It was such a brilliant topic, and the journey that we went through over the last hour and a bit was just fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yeah, and we're doing pretty well to answer what's real, what matters, and how to make the world better in an hour and a half is not bad going. So yeah, thank you so much. It's been a real pleasure.
Likewise.
All right, stay in touch.
Thank you,
Jamie. Take care.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?